This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Friday, wild weather lashes large parts of the East Coast. How are regional communities handling the downpour and the threat of flooding? And Australia's darling of television, Bert Newton, is farewelled at a state funeral in Melbourne.
Bert's partnership with Paddy was everything. Both formidable talents, both deeply in love. Theirs is a story for the ages.
Heavy rains are sweeping across eastern Australia, with some places already getting more than 100 millimetres. Bone-dry farming communities in western Queensland are celebrating desperately needed falls. But further south, in parts of New South Wales and Victoria, people are getting ready for potentially damaging floods. In some areas, sandbags have been laid out and emergency workers have been busy with rescues. David Sparks has more.
As he flies over cattle properties in Queensland's far west, helicopter pilot Scotty Blackett is seeing more water than the area's had for years. He's based in Boulia, and today he's been flying around the Channel Country.
Yeah, no, there's a good bit of water down here. Baduria's been up to 110 mil at some of the stations down here, like Cameron and Sandringham. And, a good bit of runoff coming out of the hills.
And the passengers in Scotty Blackett's helicopter like what they see.
Just taking all the property managers around, just to inspect and see where all the rain's been and measure a bit up and see what's been out and about. One manager, he said there's a couple of lakes filled up, and he said in that pool for about, a good 15, 20 years.
So,
real good.
So it's good rain. It's not damaging rain.
No, it's spot on rain, yeah.
Graziers in western Queensland are hoping the heavy rainfall will help those in drought-declared areas.
Oh, just the pressure's off. You know, this time of year, it's normally 40-degree heat, and you're chasing your tail a bit, trying to keep waters up and that. But, they're going to summer with this good start, and there'll be grass, and they won't have to be shifting cattle around, and, just the pressure's off for everyone.
So it's good news in Queensland. But further south, the rain is causing problems. Parts of northern New South Wales have had more than 50 millimetres of rain, and there have been a handful of rescues. But in that area, Dubbo Mayor Stephen Lawrence says the rain has come at the wrong time of year for farmers.
It's harvest time, and this sort of rain at this particular time couldn't come at a worse time. It makes the crop a lot harder to harvest, makes it harder, to access the paddocks and so forth. But probably most importantly, it deteriorates the quality of the crop.
The New South Wales SES Acting Assistant Commissioner, Colin Malone, says so far there have been more than 260 requests for help across the state and more than 10 flood rescues, all of those stemming from people driving their cars into floodwaters.
The river systems are unpredictable and depending on where they are in New South Wales, so we're continuing to watch the systems in the northern inland of New South Wales. The flooding around there will be with us for a while. Once the rain stops, that doesn't mean the flooding goes away. It can often happen upstream in catchments, particularly that northern and northwestern New South Wales is fed out of Queensland. So it might not be rain that's occurring around them specifically. It could be rain in the catchment.
In western New South Wales, creeks have been overflowing around Broken Hill, and authorities are warning residents to be prepared for damaging winds and heavy rain in areas including Orange, Bathurst, Yass, Parkes, Wagga Wagga and Griffith. In Perthville, near Bathurst, SES volunteers have been knocking on doors where homes may come under threat, and sandbagging is underway. In Victoria, a severe weather warning has been issued for the state's east. The Bureau is warning of possible flash flooding in Gippsland and parts of the northeast.
David Sparks reporting. Well, pressure is mounting on countries to strike a meaningful deal before the end of global climate negotiations in Glasgow. The COP26 summit is facing a deadlock over the future of fossil fuels and how they'll be phased out this decade, as well as the need to financially compensate poorer countries to switch to renewables. A first draft of the COP26 accord, released a couple of days ago, acknowledged that current pledges were insufficient to avert climate catastrophe, and a new draft is expected to be drawn up that deals with climate finance. But there are real fears time is running out. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the core goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees is on life support.
Keeping the 1.5 goal within reach means reducing emissions globally by 45% by 2030. But the present set of nationally determined contributions, even if fully implemented, would still increase emissions by 2030.
Dr. Wesley Morgan is a researcher at the Climate Council and a research fellow at the Griffith University Asia Institute. He says this weekend's agreement could see countries returning to the table next year. We spoke earlier. Wesley Morgan, we're in the final days of the Glasgow summit. What's happening behind the scenes right now?
Look, the last days of any UN climate summit are a frenzy of activity. So you have negotiators from 190-plus countries. They're already exhausted from 2 weeks of talks, and they're going to be heading into late-night negotiations as they look to finalise the details of a decision text for Glasgow. And, you know, they'll all be hoping that they can get to a meaningful outcome that will ensure that Glasgow is a success, that will help us to avoid catastrophic global warming.
So the draft agreement was published a few days ago. What can we infer from that draft about what they're aiming for in the eventual agreement that we hope to see emerge over the weekend?
It reveals that there's really, the attention has narrowed to a focus that's actually about coming back next year for another summit, with countries bringing new, stronger commitments to cut their emissions this decade. So coming back next year might seem like not a strong outcome, but in fact it would be very significant, because the Glasgow summit, it comes 5 years after the 2015 Paris Agreement. We have a one-year delay because of the COVID pandemic. But the Paris Agreement set in place a framework where every 5 years countries will come back to the table with their nationally determined targets to cut their emissions. And that's why Glasgow is so significant, because it's a really, it's a test of global cooperation to tackle climate change and a test of the Paris Agreement.
So what you're saying is that countries are currently expected to return with better pledges in 2025, but that what we might get out of Glasgow this weekend is a commitment to come back in 2022 rather than 2025.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what Glasgow has clarified is that the world has made some progress, but we haven't made nearly enough progress if we're to have the future that we want.
Australia's still sticking to its Paris goal of 26 to 28%, but the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has repeatedly said that we're likely to exceed that target. So coming together again next year might benefit countries like Australia, where we can get a better handle on that 2030 target. Is that how you see it?
Australia is taking to Glasgow the same target that it took to Paris 6 years ago. And this is unfortunate, because our key friends and allies, like the United States, like the European Union, like the United Kingdom, they've all pledged to cut their emissions in half this decade. And so Australia needs to be joining our friends and allies and halving our emissions at least this decade. And Morrison says that we're on track to meet and beat our target. And if that is the case, then Australia really needs to bring a stronger set, a stronger target. The Paris Agreement requires countries to set their highest possible ambition. So if we're on track to meet and beat our target, we really need to be setting a new target.
The world's two largest economies came together yesterday, the US and China, and they had this almost shock agreement, you know, in front of the negotiators at Glasgow. Do you think that any other shocks are in the future for over the weekend? Can any surprises emerge?
The joint announcement by the US and China was very significant. I mean, they are the world's biggest emitters. They're two of the world's most powerful countries. And They really sent a signal to the talks that they want to see an outcome. They don't want to see things collapse as climate talks have, for example, in Copenhagen. They want to see a successful outcome. And they also said that they are focused on accelerating action together this decade in the 2020s. And I think that's really significant, that what we have now is not enough and we'll need to accelerate. Could we see surprises in the next day or two? We could, because what we have on the table is a draft text, and countries are, you know, if it looks like they are not going to arrive at an agreed outcome, then countries may yet be able to shift their positions. So we may see major powers providing more climate finance to help developing countries to meet the impacts of climate change, for example. So we don't know yet what might happen in the last day or two. At the moment, there's still a significant gap between the negotiating parties. So the world is waiting with bated breath to see if they can come to an agreement.
That's Dr. Wesley Morgan, a researcher at the Climate Council. Serious questions are being asked about whether yesterday's rise in unemployment is a one-off or a sign of more economic trouble ahead. The Bureau of Statistics data released yesterday showing the jobless rate at a six-month high of 5.2% as over 40,000 workers were let go in early October. The government's blaming the crushing economic impact of lockdowns, but the opposition claims problems in the jobs market run deeper than that. So what's the future like for those on the job hunt? Here's business reporter David Taylor.
The government's line on the outlook for the economy and the jobs market is a predictable one.
I think there's every reason for people to have optimism and confidence.
Yesterday's Bureau of Statistics jobs report captured employment data from the end of September to early October. New South Wales was emerging from a months-long lockdown while Victorians were very much still stuck at home. But Finance Minister Simon Birmingham reckons all the ingredients are now in place for those who want to work to grab it.
And that's evident in the consumer confidence data, in the business confidence data that's out at present. And of course, the budget policies that we put in place to encourage businesses to invest and announcements the Prime Minister's making today in terms of more than $30 million investment into food manufacturing. These are all demonstration of how we're working to get the economy going as strongly as possible once more.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is staking his re-election hopes on a big post-pandemic rebound in the economy. He spent much of this week holding campaign-style media events in both the Hunter region and Melbourne, talking up Australia's economic recovery. He's confirmed voters will go to the polls next year, with growing speculation the election will be held in May. Speaking to Melbourne's 3AW radio, he's again pitching the coalition as best placed to manage the economic transition.
Securing Australia's economic recovery. That is the major challenge Australians face and Australia faces coming out of this pandemic. Your job, your business, how much you're paying on your household bills, on your electricity costs.
Opposition leader Anthony Albanese is trying to shift the focus away from the economy. He says the next election will be fought on which party is better placed to lead the country out of the pandemic. He's speaking here with ABC Radio Melbourne.
It will be about what Australia looks like coming out of COVID, how Australia looks forward with new industries, new jobs, how we build back stronger. That will be the debate.
Sarah Hunter is the chief economist at BIS Oxford Economics. She says there are reasons for job seekers to be confident about finding a job, but nothing's guaranteed.
There's this group of people who are getting back into the labour force, which is really good news, but they just haven't got into a job yet. And that's what was coming through there. So I actually think there was a quite a lot of positives. Other things that came through, hours worked in New South Wales was up a lot by almost 4%. That's really positive too. It suggests that businesses were gearing up for reopening. And then as we go through into 22, we should see those people who are looking for a job, they'll get into a job, and so the unemployment rate will start to track back down.
Well, that's just the thing. Both Treasury and the Treasurer and the Reserve Bank have in mind an unemployment rate back below 5%. You think that's realistic?
Yeah, I do think that's realistic to expect from where we are now. If we look at the forward indicators for the labour markets, the job vacancies, the number of job adverts, they're really strong. And you do need to look at the very high frequency, the most recent data prints for that. Unfortunately, economists are always working with data that comes through with a bit of a lag, but those do look very positive. It does look as though lockdown easing, New South Wales, Victoria, those economies are reopening and businesses are looking to hire. And we should see, you know, that in and of itself will be positive for jobs growth and should drive the unemployment rate down. I do think it is realistic to expect it to come back down, but I do think we're going to get some weird and wonderful movements through the next couple of months. It won't necessarily jump straight back down in the next data print that we get.
BIS Oxford Economics Chief Economist Sarah Hunter speaking with our business reporter David Taylor. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. It's not unusual to hear about major criminal cases involving drugs, but this time it's not an illegal drug like cocaine or ice. It's a little-known Australian plant being farmed in regional Queensland. Pharmaceutical manufacturers have exploited the native Dubuisia plant for decades as part of an opaque global supply chain. The industry's so far avoided scrutiny, but now one company is facing a string of criminal cartel charges. John Daly reports.
Near Kingaroy in Queensland, they're busy harvesting a little-known drug crop. The native Dubuisia plant is used in treatments for stomach pain and travel sickness. Retired agronomist Ian Crosthwaite says the industry started in the Second World War supplying medication for Allied soldiers.
In the early days, it was really just like a hunter-gatherer, you know, where they went out into the scrub, cut some trees, harvested the leaves.
It's now a lucrative drug trade, tightly controlled by major pharmaceutical companies. The drug extracted from the Dubuisia plant is called hyoscine. While it has medicinal benefits in small doses, in larger quantities it can cause hallucinations.
Which one's which, so I can put them back. So the Myoporoides and the Larchardi, those ones will grow into plants that contain hyoscine.
Pharmacy expert Catherine Stedman studies the drug and says it has a long history of use in Indigenous culture.
Dubuisia Myoporoides, as it grew only in the eastern states, Queensland and New South Wales, was probably more about for rituals in order to produce like a dissociative state.
Too much hyoscine can lead to amnesia and serious illness, and pharmaceutical companies have spent millions breeding varieties of Dubuisia plants with high drug content. Ian Crosthwaite says they patent the genes of their crops to protect them from competitors.
They're in a very, very, very competitive world, and so any marketing edge or any edge that they can get, you know, they will keep that.
Growers say they are controlled with strict contracts and they know little about the supply chain.
And once it leaves the farm gate, you don't have any idea of what's going on. So, yeah, very secretive industry and very controlling.
This farmer wants to remain anonymous for fear of financial reprisals.
So you basically have to accept their terms and conditions and supply them, and if you don't like it, you get out of the industry.
While the industry has escaped scrutiny for years, Dubuisia processor Alkaloids of Australia is now facing 33 criminal cartel charges following an Australian Competition and Consumer Commission investigation. The ACCC alleges the company manipulated prices and restricted supply. The firm is yet to enter a plea, while its former export manager has pleaded guilty. They face fines of up to $10 million and 10 years imprisonment.
John Daly with that report. He led a life in the spotlight, and today television great Bert Newton has been remembered at a state funeral in Melbourne. 500 of his nearest and dearest gathered at St Patrick's Cathedral to remember the man who appeared across radio, television, stage and screen over a long career. Bert's longtime friend and colleague Pete Smith gave a tribute on behalf of the family, and Eddie Maguire and Premier Daniel Andrews delivered eulogies. Carly Williams has more.
But ladies and gentlemen, everyone knows that when we think and speak of Bert Newton, we are really reflecting on a duo, a double act. Bert's partnership with Paddy was everything. Theirs is a story for the ages.
Victorian Premier Dan Andrews encapsulating the standout theme of this very public state funeral. Dressed in black with a black face mask, Paddy Newton arrived at Melbourne's St Patrick's Cathedral, flanked by her family and hand in hand with her granddaughter, ready to say a final goodbye to her late husband, Bert Newton. The screen and stage legend died just 10 days shy of his and Paddy's 47th wedding anniversary. It might have been a sombre occasion with grey weather to match, but Paddy blew kisses and waved to cameras as she walked to the front row of the cathedral. A string of entertainment stars were there to honour the one they lovingly called Moonface and his career that spanned more than five decades. Dan Andrews was first to speak.
Bert Newton was a great entertainer, and life itself was his stage. He was always there, omnipresent, on our screens and in our homes. To Australia, Bert wasn't just a man on a screen or an actor on a stage. He was someone we all felt we knew. Like a fireplace on a cold night, families would gather around their TV sets, drawn in by Bert's warmth and sustained by his inviting ease. Bert was more than talent. He was trust.
Eddie Maguire was there to share messages from A-listers Hugh Jackman and Russell Crowe and tell stories about Bert we may not have heard.
Of Bert hearing of a man dying of HIV/AIDS at a time when sufferers were stigmatised and isolated. Not only did Bert visit and spend hours with every person in the ward, but gave the man one of his beloved gold logies. An amazing gesture, one that lifted the morale of all in the depths of their despair, with the only reward being that Bert gave those on their worst day something to remember as their best.
Singer Anthony Kalia sang the prayer accompanied by John Foreman. Bert's longtime friend and colleague Pete Smith read a letter from his son Matthew Newton, who was unable to travel from New York.
One final conversation a few days before we lost him was different from the usual, and we both knew it. But we eschewed the stories and the laughs and just said how much we loved each other. During this wonderful chat, my mother was pottering around in the background, adding her two cents every now and again and doing lovely things for Dad, as usual. Dad leaned into the phone camera and whispered, "I think she's poisoning my food, Matthew."
Bert Newton passed away nearly 2 weeks ago after a lengthy health battle. He was 83 years old. He rose to fame supporting television hosts Graham Kennedy and Don Lane and became so popular he won 4 gold Logies on his own. As Eddie Maguire put it at today's memorial,
"Show business and this city will never be the same. The young boy from Fitzroy who became a star, then a legend, then an institution, and now our greatest memory of the golden years of television. Forever, our Bert."
TV personality Eddie Maguire there, Carly Williams reporting. And we'll end this week's program with another look at the life of Albert Watson Newton, AM, MBE, the award-winning entertainer, radio and television personality and presenter, stage performer, Logie Hall of Fame inductee, 4-time Gold Logie winner and host of the Logie Awards 19 times.
Albert Watson Newton.
That's a little shocking name.
I like the boy.
Did you say Roy or boy?
I like the boy. Is something wrong with saying that?
Roy.
Yeah. Hey, hang on. No. I'll change religion. I'll do anything for you. I don't care. What's wrong with saying that? I like the boy.
I have an affliction. It's called emotion. And, oh, shit.
Congratulations, Mike.
I don't think I've ever really been in love with anybody else. I've always loved Bert. We've been together a long, long time. We went together for a long time before we were married, and then I went overseas for 3 years because he wouldn't marry me. And then he married me, and I can't say that I'm... I suppose every day I think how lucky I am that I've got him.
Yes,
and I hope I never lose him.
That was lovely.
Well, Bert, you're 37.
Just as I wrote it, by the way.
Oh, was it just as you wrote it?
I've been able to do the things that I dreamt of professionally, but also personally. To have such a beautiful wife, Patty, 2 wonderful kids, and now a second life with the grandchildren.
Rara, boop, yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah.
This is pretty close to perfection.
Yeah.
And that's all from the World Today team for this week. The program's producers are Sarah Sedgie and Catherine Gregory. Associate producer is Barney Porter. Technical production by David Sargent. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. I'm Rachel Mealy. Stay safe and have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley, and I'm from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. In the past decade or so, Australia has witnessed a revolution in how we talk about many once hidden crimes and disorders. But despite that, incestuous abuse and the condition it can trigger, dissociative identity disorder, remain taboo. So what, if anything, do we know about them? Today on The Signal, we're talking with Background Briefing's Tracy Shelton about the last unspeakable crime and about how those who suffered it find their voice. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.